This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Everyone, I want to welcome us to Thriving as an Asian American Christian in the Academy with Dr. Tim Tseng. He's the Executive Director at the Institute for the Study of Asian American Christianity, or ISAAC. He's also an alumni of my alma mater, NYU. Woohoo! He has both his MDiv and his PhD from Union Theological Seminary, and his PhD was on church history. His focus was on Asian American studies, and he's currently teaching at the University of San Francisco in the area of Asian culture, religion, and philosophy. One quirky fact about the man of the moment is that he loves getting mail, and not just any mail, snail mail, and he will even stand at the door waiting for the mailman to deliver his mail. It is his joy. Yes. And without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Tim Tseng.
Thank you. And I want to add to that that desire for picking up mail has transferred into the electronic format. So now I stand in front of my computer waiting for emails. Well, anyway, why don't we go around and introduce ourselves? You can say a little bit about who you are, and if you're in an academic track, say a little bit about where you are there. Some of you may be faculty, young faculty. Some of you may not be in academic track. Sure about that too. And it'd be good just to find out how we came to this particular workshop. So I'll put Jennifer on the spot since I know you.
My name's Jennifer. I know Tim Tseng.
Yes.
I get
mail from her.
I'm on staff with InterVarsity, and my 10th year on InterVarsity staff, and I'm the National Interim Coordinator of Asian American Ministries for InterVarsity. So we oversee our ministry work with all our students, as well as staff of Asian descent. And mostly, primarily, we've focused a lot on the undergraduates, and we're kind of at this point, trying to think about how do we reach Asian Americans in the academy and faculty and stuff. So, yeah.
My name is Gary. I am a fourth year BME, a biomedical engineering PhD student at Harvard. And yes, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri.
Whoa.
All right.
Do you have a St. Louis connection?
No, I'm just surprised there's Asians in Missouri.
There's actually a history about Chinatown there.
Really?
Yeah, recently written.
Wow.
Okay. My name is Changgai Kwong. I'm from the University of Minnesota, chemical engineering, fifth year, I should say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love it.
they gave you that shirt.
Don't get the shirt.
Every
time. Yeah,
I'm like, what else? It's like a college.
That's true.
Hi, my name is Yvonne. I'm an assistant professor at Columbia Graduate University in politics and policy.
Which is what in policy?
Politics and policy.
Okay. Great, thank you.
So I'm Rosalind. I'm a six-year student at Mount Sinai Medical School. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that's in New York City. Mm-hmm.
Woohoo!
Oh, yeah.
Let me just introduce myself.
I'm Cheryl. I'm an engineer.
You're an educator?
An engineer.
Engineer.
Is this for people who are not students? Is this session?
It's for both. It's for anyone who is trying to get into academic or in the academic world.
I'm a PhD student in computer science. I study video games at UC Santa Cruz.
All right, Santa Cruz. My son might go there.
Okay. Yeah. For grad or undergrad?
Undergrad.
I'm Jane Kim, and I'm based in New York, actually, and I've been leading the business track in Washington for the last couple of days. I actually met Tim a couple of years ago at the LT Foundation Conference. I actually do executive coaching and leadership training, and I do a lot of work in culture, and I've done a lot of work with Asians in the workplace, mostly with companies, but I've done some work with some other industries, too. So I'm really excited to kind of hear what you're doing and doing some good things.
I want to add that she also authored Breaking the Bamboo Ceiling, so I hope you get a copy of that book, and I'm actually going to be using a review of that book in this session.
Oh, thank you.
So,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't plan to have her in this session, but now that you're here, I can...
Yes,
No.
It's real time.
As we do in the academic community, it'll be as harsh and critical as we needed to be. And then this, I think... you all of you would, if you're not going to, if you decide not to stay in academic tracks, you'd be a great person to talk to and get to know. Because she has a real experience in helping companies understand and work with Asian Americans and helping Asian Americans survive the corporate world.
My name is Dan Wong. I'm a first year PhD student in organizational behavior at the University of Maryland. And so 4 to 5 years from now, I plan on becoming a professor in organizational behavior at a business school. So this session, I'm trying to figure out what it means to be an Asian American professor.
Great.
My name is Kayum Khan. I'm of Pakistani Afghani descent. I'm a third year non-tenure track assistant professor, which means I'm on the job market.
Yes.
Which is a very hard job market nowadays.
Yeah,
the world will plant me, I'll be happy.
Which area are you?
In mathematics.
Mathematics.
In Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jean Lee. I was listening. I really was to all of you guys.
Sure.
I'm studying literature, English literature, at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
All right.
This is my first semester, and it was brutal, but I loved it. So here
you mean
I
the weather?
Even the weather. God has been good. He turned Illinois beautiful this year.
Okay.
It's weird. So, I was surprised that there's... this means something, being an Asian American academia. What does this mean? I do not know.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure that out. That's why I brought you here. Are you in, Urbana has, Illinois has an Asian American studies program. Are you involved with that at all? In your
I probably will be.
Okay. Is literature, Asian American studies, history, social sciences then?
Yes. Precisely the direction I'm going in.
Okay. Great. Okay.
And I'm Anna Lee. I'm a staff worker with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship at NYU with the grad and faculty ministries, and I'm the seminar room coordinator today to push your buttons for you.
She's also the principal organizer of last night's reception and a lot of the activities here. So
thank you.
So Anna is great. And she did this while she was on her honeymoon in Hawaii.
I'll tell the husband.
You mean he didn't know? That's not a good way to start your marriage, you know?
Strike that from the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, James. So as you can see, some of us here know each other fairly well, and so it's like a big happy family. And I hope that spirit of community continues past this room. And I'd like this session not to just be informational, but also formational. So hopefully as you get to know each other better and maybe pray for each other as you go down your future career paths, there'll be opportunities to reconnect. So in the spirit of that, I'm going to pass around an attendance sheet so you can fill that in and give me your email addresses. So I don't want to plug Isaac too much because our organization, I will plug certain aspects of which I think may be relevant to you. But our organization primarily is looking to do more research in the area of Asian American Christianity. And that's very broadly defined, whether it's in the corporate world or in the academic sector. Right now, our main focus is academic theology and education and congregations, churches. So we're really interested in working with faith-based organizations and with academic organizations. But in the future, maybe... if Jane can show me how, we can learn to work on marketplace issues for Asian American Christians in the marketplace as well. So we'll see. We're praying for guidance from God on that. And the slideshow that's going on back there will just continue to go around and around until you get it into your system. Huh? What happened? It shipped into my email. Why? Why did it do that?
It knew your love of mail.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay. I didn't even turn on my email system. What happened? It did it automatically.
Oh.
It's attuned to my brain waves. Some of you who are into engineering or high tech, I noticed that just by going around, most of you are not in the, except for, what's your name again?
Jean.
Are not really into the humanities and social sciences, which is my forte. I know Jennifer is, because you're going into theology. Right, so theology is a social science, isn't it? So given that, I think that the approach of this workshop will probably take on a little bit of different coloring. And I really, really do encourage you to share from your own experience, because I don't have that experience in the so-called hard sciences or the maths or organizational and business management background. So your experiences are going to be just as important as you share about what you're going through as you're working through your academic training. But the main purpose of our session, I'll get some handouts to you. And we can just follow along. And while that's going around, USF is having this Religion and Globalization in Asia Forum conference in mid-March. So if any of you want to come out to the Bay Area for this, please do come. I'll pass this around to you. It's a whole session devoted to the study of religion in Asia. Hmm. And I have flyers for Isaac if you want to pick one up. We can edit all this out because it's just time fillers. Is there someone in charge of that? Okay. Let's begin by looking at this sheet that I gave you. I'm trying my best to think about questions around, and this is something that Isaac is very concerned about, because we actually formed a Society for Asian North American Christian Studies. We're very concerned about cultivating and bringing together scholars who care about Asian Christianity, Asian American Christianity, and from any field, so that we could find a chance to support each other and help each other grow. Because within the academy, it seems that the study of Christianity, with the exception of Christian schools, is really not a very strong emphasis across the board. So given that, what we hope to do is begin to bring those of us who are interested in Asian American Christianity, not just as a faith perspective, but also as a subject for study, just to talk to each other and build each other up. Okay, so that's one of our larger goals. But for this workshop, if I can just go through that, the question that I want to raise is given Barack Obama's election to the presidency, how many of you voted for him, by the way? Obama? I put you on the spot there. Okay, good. And those of you who voted for the other way or didn't vote, that's okay. But given that, I'm not going to focus on his party affiliation, but given the fact that he is a multiracial person, what does that say about the future of those of us who are racial minorities in this country, especially Asian Americans? What does that mean? Are we ready to now celebrate that everything's okay? And we don't have to talk about race anymore. We don't have to deal with identity issues anymore. Are we done with that? So that's one of the questions I want to raise here. And then the second question is, those of us who are people of faith, what does that mean in that context? Mm-hmm. Right. So faith, race, and our vocations are, I think, very central issues to address as we grow, as Christians grow and mature as individuals. So that's one of the questions I hope that we can address. And specifically for Asian Americans, we have a number of issues that I hope that you can also share with me. One is that we are overrepresented in the academia. Right? Our numbers, population-wise, are something like, yes?
I think that Asians and Asian Americans are very different, though. Like, okay. I know they always put them together, but I don't feel we're the same.
Say more.
What?
Say more about that.
Well, it's just that, like, I'm the only Asian American, like, well, there's some, like, halfway half Asian, but, like, I'm the only Asian American in my department, but then, like, there's, like, a gazillion people from China and everywhere else.
Good.
In India and stuff there. And I still feel like a minority. I'm only like a minority or a majority of that.
Good. That's a really, really very, very important issue, because in theological education, the same thing occurs. And what often happens is that if you look at all across the United States, all the seminaries in America, there is a significant number of Asian faculty, but I think only about 3 who are Asian American, who are born and raised here, who use English, who understand the Asian American context. So if you were to get a theological education, you might be able to find a professor who might be able to give you some insight about Korea or Japan or China, but not about Asian Americans. So you're absolutely right. That's a big issue. Hang on to that. I think we need to talk about that. Okay. Where were we? Yeah, I was saying that we were overrepresented, but you're right. That's too simple a statement. But by the numbers, there are more, even more Asian Americans, at least who are students, than our population. So the impression is that we're doing okay. We're using the U.S. educational system to the best of our abilities as Asian Americans, and we don't have any problems. We have no issues. But I think, I don't know how you feel, but maybe this is something you can share with me, but I think that it goes deeper than that. And what I hope we can do in this workshop is to think about that collectively and find ways to address it and address that and apply that to our faith as well. So the questions I hope we can address is how can we enter, survive, sustain, and thrive in the demanding world of academia? And secondly, how do we integrate our faith, vocation, and identities? I don't think we can get to all these questions, but I do think that at least what I'm hoping to do is just set the framework for a conversation, and maybe in the future we can continue talking over email and maybe developing further ideas. How does this sound to you? I mean, I'm open to changing it too. I just want to make sure that you're okay. You came here, you know, hoping to address these issues. Okay, good.
Sounds good.
Okay, let's move then. I'm going to start with something like a little speech, a little burp. I know those of you who know me well, I hate to give lectures. Okay? I'm not a motivational speaker. In fact, I'm a demotivational speaker. when I talk, people fall asleep. They surf the web. And so that's why I'll keep my words very limited, okay? Because I don't want to demotivate you and get you so discouraged from. The second part of our session, I'd like for you to discuss with each other and with me some of the issues that you see based on your own experience. And then we'll start to address some of the theoretical frameworks around that, which address some of the issues that I forgot your name and you raised. yeah,
Cheryl.
And you're actually a faculty member right now.
No.
Oh, okay. You're in a PhD. Okay. It's okay. I'll eventually get it right. Okay. So let's start by looking at some of the foundational assumptions that I'd like to share with you about. And I have this subtitle, The Theology of Scholarship, and hopefully this will help. First of all, I think that when we look at going into the academic field, many of us do it because we are very interested in the subject, and we feel so drawn to it that we want to continue to do research in it. We just have this this passion for thinking through issues. That's a good motive. But from a Christian perspective, I think there are other reasons why we should go into academics. And one is to consider academics as a Christian vocation. It really is a part of our calling. It is ministry. It really is, because you're in touch, whether you're in wherever you're teaching, with people who also need to hear the gospel, with people who have opportunities to interact with you and learn about your faith. And so you are in a very important position in the church and in society. And it's also a vocation because the study, the fact that one engages with their mind, that itself has intrinsic value for spiritual growth, believe it or not. So I'm not a mathematician, but I'm sure. How do I pronounce your name? Kellen?
Kayun.
Okay, you can tell us about how math and your faith integrate, because it does have some sort of intrinsic value for growth. And I don't need to convince you of this, but every single time I study the history, this, and I discover an archive of these Korean old-timers who came to America, and they started a church in Hawaii, for example, in 1910, and I read about their stories, it inspires me. So there is a place where I get spiritual growth from looking back in history. Secondly, you as an academician have special gifts for the church and for the kingdom. And I would label them, and these are not exhaustive, as traditioning, the gift of passing along to the next generation your faith. And even if you are in a secular environment where you're not supposed to be proselytizing, your witness as a Christian is very vital, just to let people know that Jesus Christ has a purpose in your life and for your students as well. Secondly, you also have an edifying gift. And this is a little tricky because very often churches don't want you to, you know, they may not invite you as a mathematician to speak at the church about spirituality. But if our engineer, but you will also be given places in in churches and Christian communities where you get a chance to speak and to build up the church and to edify your brothers and sisters in Christ. So wherever you're positioned, you will have opportunities. So you have an edifying gift as well. And the reason for that is because you're recognized by society and by the church as a person who has gone through a certain path that actually gives you a place to speak and some authority to speak. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. And finally, you have a prophetic role. Because the church doesn't always get it right. In fact, sometimes it never does, but it really does. And sometimes, using your critical a way of engaging materials, you can help the church to think more carefully about what they ought to be doing. So academics is a vocation. It really is. For me, I didn't realize this. I was not a very good undergrad student. In fact, I started off because my parents pressured me to be a pre-med at NYU. And I didn't do well. I was so poor that the dean of the program actually wrote me a threatening letter saying I'd be expelled if I don't get my GPA up. So I switched out of the hardcore sciences. I said, no organic chemistry for me. I latched onto psychology because that was the only way to graduate on time. And I did it, and I finally got out of my bachelor's. But I never expected, given that experience, to get into a PhD program. So when I started when I enrolled in my theological in seminary for my Master of Divinity, I was primarily identifying myself as a pastor, someone who would go and minister in the church. But I never realized that I would get into academics. I think that that happened because, of course, of God's grace and people who really cared about me. They thought I had some promise, so I managed to get into a PhD program despite my horrible undergrad experience. So I'm an example of God's grace in that regard. But once in, I had to face a very difficult choice. Should I go into full-time pastoral ministry, or should I just plow ahead and finish up this damn degree? Sorry.
Right.
It didn't get covered. But because it was hard. My first son was born just about at the middle of my dissertation stage. And it was very difficult. I was a part-time pastor at my father's church. So it was one of those circumstances where the easiest path would have been to say, forget about the PhD and just go straight into ministry, because at that time and moment, there was it was easier to go that way. That path was an easier path. But I think some good advice from some great mentors in my seminary encouraged me to go into academics. They encouraged me to see that what I'm doing has value for the kingdom. So I hope that would be true for you. A second thing for consideration foundationally is that academics is also an act of advocacy. First of all, even if you're in a hardcore or science or a more objective science, there is a myth that I think you probably have come to realize, that there is no such thing as academic objectivity. Okay, right? And those of you who are in engineering sciences probably disagree, right? But those of us who are in the social sciences say, no, even that, there's no objectivity. Okay? A good example is colorblind scholarship. There are some people who really believe that you can do certain kinds of academic activities without regards to social context, like race, gender. But in whatever field you're in, those social conditions will color the research. And so therefore, as an academic, your role is not simply to be an objective, know-it-all person, to try to find truth and just bring it out. This is pure, unadulterated truth. You have a role in shaping the kinds of messages that you communicate. So consequently, I would say that if you're an academic, you also probably need to be aware that you may have an advocacy role in supporting particular concerns that are ethically important. Just to give you an example, in Wheaton College, there's an institute called the Institute for the Study of Asian. No, I'm sorry, for the Study of American Evangelicalism. No, we're not going to Wheaton. And that's an organization that was established primarily for the historical field, to let the historians know that there's a need to study evangelicalism in America. Because in the 80s, 70s and 80s, no one knew what that was. Jimmy Carter had come to faith, had come and said, I'm a believer, I'm born again. But the media, no one knew what an evangelical was. So this organization came up to advocate the more research in this arena. So that's an example of advocacy. So whatever you do, I think there's a, some degree of that I hope that you will bear in mind. That's part of your vocation as an academic. You have to stand up for a cause, for something. It's the worst kind of academics I know are the ones who just get tenured and just do nothing. And I support tenure. I'm not saying that tenure is a bad system. I do think that there is a reality that once faculty get tenured, they lose it. They just don't have any motive or drive anymore. So if you keep this in mind, that academics has some advocacy. Whatever you do in your career has consequences, positive or negative. Another example of this is Asian American studies, ethnic studies. Ethnic studies is not an objective field of study. It was born out of a need to correct an injustice, which is still prevalent today. Like my son is in high school, and he took a course on, let's say, global history in California. You know, California is a very diverse state with no majority population. But if I look through the curriculum, there's hardly anything about African Americans, Asian Americans, or any other minorities. And even the global studies program is mostly about how the West got so good. And whenever they talk about China or Africa, they just happen to be conquered by us. You know? So when I look at that curriculum, I say, well, what is our next generation learning about the future? So I think that that's a reason why I feel so strongly that there's a need to see the advocacy angle. So most of Asian American studies, ethnic studies, and gender studies came up with a concern to correct the politics of knowledge, to make it one which is more more equitable and more fair and more just for everyone involved. Okay, so interrupt me if I say anything that triggers something. I don't like to lecture, so I'll pause for a second and see if you want to say anything. Did I rub you the wrong way yet? That's my goal. Okay, all right. And the third thing, and then I'll ask you to start to interact with me. This has to do with the Asian American churches, and I put in parentheses anti-intellectual consumers, question mark. And here is where I think you and I will probably find the biggest struggle. Once you're in an academic arena and your context is focused in that setting, when you go back to a local church, it's very different. It looks different. And this may be true for other professions too. Because the local church sometimes begins to look very petty. You know, you have all kinds of people at different intellectual levels and different critical skills, sometimes some people with none at all who are in leadership and doing things that rub you the wrong way. People say things in churches that often don't sound right. And I think in particular, those of us who are in the biological sciences, probably, not when I say us, not me, but those of you who are in the biological sciences probably have a hard time with all this intelligent design stuff that's coming out of the churches. So I think that in that regard, we still need to think of what is our role, the responsibility of the academic person and the church, okay? And in particular the Asian churches. If you're not part of an Asian American church, this still applies, but that Asian American piece is not there. Well, there are some negatives and positives about this situation that I'd like to share, and then I'll move to the next step. One is that the Asian American churches, in particular immigrant ones, are still very marginal from the mainstream academic institutions. And my wife, actually, she moonlights as a college admission advisor. And what she has noticed is that most of the mothers and fathers in my church, I go to a Chinese immigrant church, and they don't speak English very well. They don't really understand the American educational system. But they all push their kids to go to Stanford, Harvard, Yale, UC Berkeley, you know, without even knowing what does that mean. Because these are name brand schools. So without even getting a chance to engage critically about what are these really a good fit for your kids, and maybe look at some really good schools that are smaller. You know, there are some real, real top-notch liberal arts schools, Claremont McKenna, out in the East Coast, or all in Western Massachusetts. They're not even aware of that. So I see them mostly as marginalized consumers who want to have the best, but they don't think about what that means. So that's what I mean, the anti-intellectual. Yes?
I have a question and a comment on that. I can kind of understand your viewpoint about maybe some ignorance, some hostility towards people in academics, but I would have imagined that because they have this view of kind of name brand schools, they also have, whether it's justified or not, a high value in education.
Sure.
So I would have expected the opposite, that they would put more value on those who are highly educated.
I'll get to that other part about the value system, the value about educated, and I have something to say about that. But in terms of my wife's experience with our church people, they do value education. They believe it, but they don't really critique it. So they don't really think about what it really is about. What is their value system around education? So that's the piece I'm criticizing. It's not enough just to value education, but you have to know what it is. Don't just send people to the McDonald's. No. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
So then I feel like there's another like separation, right? Because there's Asian Americans whose parents came to get PhDs,
right.
And there's Asian American. My parents came to be waiters in Chinese restaurants, and then
right.
like even with them, I felt like I guess in a sense underprivileged when I compared myself to them because their parents spoke English well and knew the college system, but my parents barely went through
right.
college.
Your parents and my wife's parents are the same. My wife came to America, and her parents were. They worked in Chinatown. Her mother was a seamstress, and her father was a chef. And so you're absolutely right. There is that class distinction too between those who have educated status. And even there, though, the people in our church, even people from that background, still follow the same kind of trend of just going after name brand schools. But you're right. Within our church, we have those type of differences too that are not spoken of, but are really critical in terms of how we prepare our future generation. Right, let's go back to some of these points. I want to just sort of race this through this, and maybe we'll retouch it, and we'll see. But yeah, again, one of the things that is important to keep in mind is regardless of how educated or how wealthy an Asian American immigrant church is, they're still marginal from the academic institutions, and they tend to see them through those types of lenses of just name brand. That reflects the aspiration to succeed. But there's not enough thinking about what that really means. And part of it is just lack of resources to figure out how do I discern what's the best education for my kids. Another thing that is part of it is not related to the Asian American piece, but Mark Noll wrote it about 10 years ago, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think that still holds for all of us who come out of that tradition. There's certainly a place where suddenly when we go to our faith, we put aside everything that relates to our thinking. And I think that's something that we need to be careful and recognize as part of the church traditions that we come out of. Therefore, most of the churches and church leaders don't think of the academic community as a place, as a priority to make an impact on. And I would hope that that would change. But that's, maybe this is where InterVarsity can help, but you know, you work mostly with students, right, and here with faculty. So hopefully we'll see more of the Asian American churches getting involved with this type of ministry, impacting the academic institutions. Third thing, when you look at seminary education, the people who train our pastors and leaders, they still ignore and neglect Asian American ministry and communities. And this is where your comment came about, where when seminaries, the politics of seminary education is that you bring an Asian on campus, everyone's happy, regardless of whether that faculty member really understands the subject matter. So that happens a lot in a lot of seminaries. I hate to do this to Fuller, but I'll say it because I like Fuller Seminary. But just to give you an example, at Fuller Seminary, okay, what are you pointing at here for? Okay. No, I can say this, but they're trying to change. Okay, so, but this is what's happened to them. In their School of Intercultural Studies, which used to be the School of World Mission, they have two Korean doctorate ministry programs. Oh no, they have one, and there's another one in the School of Theology. Fuller, as you know, is like a university. They have three different schools. They have a School of Psychology, a School of Theology, and a School of Intercultural Studies. So they have a Korean doctorate ministry program in the School of Intercultural Study, a Korean doctorate program in the School of Theology. All of these programs are conducted in Korean. Okay. So for the longest time, the Fuller administrators thought, oh yeah, we're doing a great job with diversity. Okay. So I think it's not until recently where I think some of the other groups, other Asians are beginning to say, look, you know, there's a significant population of English-speaking Asians who maybe one fifth of your student body are English-speaking Asian Americans, and we're not getting the kinds of training that we need. So that's been an ongoing discussion for the last 20 years, and I think they're finally beginning to address that. But that's just an example where seminaries tend to ignore the Asian American communities, and I think that could translate to colleges too. But there's some positives, okay, and I think that the positives around academics and church traditions is that, first of all, there is a tradition among many mainline Protestants that respect good scholarship and academics. So this anti-intellectualism was not there for the older generation of Protestants, but secondly, it's also changing among the younger evangelicals in America. There is a growing intellectual sophistication, if I can use that word non-elitistly, among evangelicals, and I think InterVarsity is one of the on the vanguard of doing that. So I think that within the next generation, I see this as a potential opportunity for all of you to get on board, because there's going to be some exciting changes in the academic community if all of you can hang in there and start publishing and producing the kind of information that reflects your faith as well, because there's a growing edge there. That will be heard, that wasn't heard in my generation, but it will be heard in yours. So I think, despite that, this is a great opportunity to impact the Asian American churches, both the ethnic and the pan-Asian American churches, help them become less anti-intellectual, to bring them on board so they can work with you on impacting the academy in America. Okay, that's it. The speech is over. Any thoughts about that? It's just sort of random thinking around foundational issues, but. Any other thoughts?
It's hopeful.
It was one positive point.
Out of all the negatives, right?
I'm sorry. It's okay. I'm sure this outweighs all the.
Well, you know, I also kind of appreciate the anti-intellectual side of the church, because as one who didn't do well as an undergrad, I don't think that it's good to carry on this era of intellectual elitism. But I have to, you know, that's one of the things we might have to learn, is how to learn to work with people who don't have the same training that we have, like Sarah Palin. I'm sorry. Oops, sorry. That was bad. No. Okay. Let me turn the focus to you. What I'd like to do now is ask you. I was going to originally find out how many of you are grad students, how many of you are faculty, and how many of you are in the humanities and social sciences, and how many of you are in the hard sciences and business. But I don't think we can break off into so many small groups. You know, let me see. We have two person in the humanities, right? And there's most of you are grad students. A couple of you are faculty. So let's do this as one group and see how it turns out. Okay. Mm-hmm. Here, I want you to say freely, based on your experience, what are some of the issues that you face in the academic world? It might be issues around survival. There might be issues around discrimination, whether it's because you feel that your faith is being marginalized or your race is being marginalized. But why don't you share a little bit, you know, about what you think are the issues that are important. And it doesn't have to be the most important, just issues, just tossing on a list. Anyone want to start?
Okay, to be honest, mm-hmm. I'm just going to be forward about my ignorance in this issue. I am pretty naive when it comes to academia. I'm still doughy-eyed and incredibly idealistic about the whole bunch. Though I'm able to criticize it, I'm still more optimistic about it. So I'm actually unaware, maybe because I've had such a brief encounter with it in graduate school. I'm unaware of what I should be looking for. And a very wise author told me that we should all be, of course, as innocent as doves, but as wise as serpents, or as lambs. And I just thought that's the primary reason why I came here. If people could shed some insight into what I should be looking for.
Good. Yeah, I think we will. Any of you, maybe you have some insight since you're teaching right now, but maybe let's stick with that question of what other issues we'll go back and forth on that.
Well, I teach at a secular private university, and this is just a temporary job, and they put me kind of in a flow position, so I just go according to supply and demand.
Right.
And because I teach in a kind of a hard science, I can't really bring in faith or anything like that, but try to bring in the notion of discipline that I think some of the students are lacking, coming from very privileged, spoiled backgrounds.
Okay, ouch. That sounds like you've had some students.
at Vanderbilt.
Oh. Okay.
So, I mean, quite a few of them have servants at home, and they used to, you know, I'm not saying all of them. Some of them have financial aid, but they used to kind of putting in a small amount of effort, complaining a lot, and getting an inflated grade from high school, mainly first semester freshman.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want, you know, I've been getting worse and worse ratings. This is personal. On ratemyprofessor.com.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
no.
Okay, maybe we'll get it.
But, yeah. Well, I tried to pray before. But I try to deal with most private schools have a center for teaching or director for teaching. I try to talk with these people who are maybe had a Christian upbringing but are atheist or
right.
non-believers. So I try to work within the authority system, but still I have this feeling now as my last semester that based on evaluations and things like that, I think mainly Caucasian American students who are usually very rich, and I didn't want to say this in the beginning, but now I feel like because I'm kind of a person of color, first person of color in authority over them coming from high school, that unless I could be their best friend and their peer, that I don't want to do that. I want to actually be an authority over them. You know, biblically that teachers have a high calling, there's a high price. Even with the rabbis that you'd be twice the son of hell. It's not only accounting for who you are, but how you've led other people, that I felt that maybe out of their uneasiness, they are saying these bad things.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the worst part of the race aspect, because you never know.
And there's these websites, like, they just banned it recently on campus, but I think Juicy Campus, I mean, you heard about that scandal?
No.
Quite a lot of racist statements are just being put up there anonymously. So I think maybe several universities are banning it.
Mm-hmm.
You say it about students or faculty, right?
Yeah.
It's the ugly side of things.
The two transitions that you're describing, I'm very familiar with. My first teaching position was at Denver Seminary in Colorado. And I grew up in New York City, where it's very cosmopolitan, you know, great people like Anna and NYU Fellowship. But when I went out to Colorado, the evangelical community there was very different from New York City's. And I was also trained at a seminary which really valued great lecturers. We had some of the best lecturers at Union Seminary. And I didn't want to have student discussions. I just wanted to hear lecturers talk, because they were so eloquent. They just were able to communicate so effectively. So when I went to Denver, my aspiration was to model that. But I discovered a very different student culture, and the same things that you're talking about. And furthermore, I remember there were some evaluations where students were saying that they didn't understand my accent.
What?
What? Really?
Right. They just say that. They just make that comment.
Right, right. And that's something that does happen with a lot of us who look foreign. We tend to, even if we speak English fluently, there's a tendency for that to happen. So so I think that that's something to think about, and maybe we can talk specifically about how to deal with that.
I think typically I've seen, I think with grad students especially, they get that as a comment on their teaching evaluation.
Exactly, which is completely unfair, but you can tell right there that the biases are your race and your physical features are a marker, more so than your competence. So that's something that could be watching out for. I think especially in the hard sciences, because those of us who go to liberal arts are sort of forced to go through this political correct filter of being diverse and respectful, but people who go through the hard sciences and engineering don't necessarily have that opportunity to get squeezed that way. So in your case, I can see that happening very easily.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep that in mind. I want to bring that up again later. Anyone else want to share some of the issues that you see? Yeah.
Only a trained professor related to science.
Mm-hmm.
My identities, I found my identities in this conference.
Oh, good.
Actually,
excellent.
I thought it is special. I never thought that it's special, but I am Christian, Korean, female,
mm-hmm.
female, international faculty mm-hmm. in political science. So it's really rare to find actually Christian faculty members in political science
mm-hmm.
and Korean and international and female.
Yeah.
And I got my PhD from UCLA, and I never felt any racism or discrimination against me because I'm female Asian. I even felt some favor for me. And they did treat me, you know, equally. So sometimes I felt like this barrier set from, you know, I'm international students. But I, you know, didn't have any problem. I think, you know, probably because UCLA is really has lots of Asian, you know, students, and they got really familiar with that. And you know, you'll be on the market. I was on the market last year, and I had like 4 interviews. And what I found was actually, you know, as an Asian female students, you even have some, you know, advantage. They're looking for some minority, even if there's no affirmative action right now, but still, they're trying to have some diversity, especially in political science. I had interviews in 4 different places across the country, and I got offers from all of them. And what I found was actually there's even discrimination against white male American students who are really good, but who is, you know, because usually if you go to a police department, it is dominated by white male American. So they try to have some diversity in their minority students. So it was okay when I get a job, but once you get a job, it's totally different.
Yeah.
So I'm the Asian female young scholar in the department. I kind of like, I just finished my first semester, so I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And it's not really because they dislike me. I think they, you know, as a person, they don't really dislike me. But I think they're white male American who just feel uncomfortable to work with
mm-hmm.
Asian female scholar. So I had 2 other colleagues, new faculty members came in together with me. One was African-American, Canadian professor, and another was Korean-American, actually, was male Korean scholar, Korean-American scholar. And I think they felt much more comfortable talking to the other 2
yes.
to me. So I thought, I don't know, it's a little subtle, but I kind of felt that they feel really uncomfortable talking to me. Maybe because I'm too young or something, I don't know. So I don't know if it is because I'm Asian female scholar, it's because I'm female scholar or Asian scholar, I don't know. I guess it's because I'm female
yeah.
scholar. But I think somehow you have to go through it and get over it. So I'm trying to do it, but so in academy, it's not just you stay in your office and produce something. You have to cooperate with other scholars to do well, and it's a little harder for you to do it once you are in professional level. So I know it's easier for me to work with my advisor, like UCLA. He doesn't have any, you know, he feels comfortable with me. But I think I'm trying to find a way to work with other, you know, white male American scholars in the department or in other fields. So,
Are your colleagues who are African American and the Korean, are they about the same age as you?
I think so.
They're younger,
so.
Right?
Yeah, they are a little older than me.
a little bit older than you, but not as old as the white colleagues.
But the thing is, I'm from Claremont Graduate University. We have School of Politics and Economics. Economics, the Department of Economics is dominated by white male American scholars. There are no Asians, no African American, no female scholars there. And political science has a few white, you know, female scholars. So they feel much more comfortable talking to me. But they're not in the same field as me, so it's hard to work with them. So I try to find someone to work with me, but yeah, it's a little hard. What I'm trying to say is it's something different for you to work in graduate program. You know, if you actually get a job and become a professor, I think even students treat you differently. I think it's different that I have her as my colleague, you know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Then you know I have her as my professor.
Did somebody want to, I thought that someone else might have wanted to respond to you. I sort of interrupted you, cut you off. Yeah. In Southern California, there's a different dynamic than Tennessee, because the Asian population is so strong there.
Yeah. So I never felt it, and I have my friend who is also a professor at Carson, and she was teaching Florida State. And she said that she felt welcome in the class in California compared to Florida.
I hate to confess it, but that's one of my motives for moving out to California. Because my second teaching position was in Colgate, Rochester, New York. And when I saw the opportunity to come to the Golden State where I could connect with more Asians, I took it. Even though it was a risky move.
Yeah, but I think that somehow, when I was working as a TA back in UCLA, I kind of felt that the students try to challenge you more. You're an Asian female TA.
Hey, anyone else want to share before we move on? Because I'm hearing some of the issues around vocational, survival. You know.
Especially struggles as a result of our identity. As
yeah, sure.
I don't know, maybe it's just my lab, but I felt like people complain a lot more than I'm comfortable with complaining a lot, and I ended up working with somebody who always had a problem with something, and I just, you know, they'd give me something to do, I wanted my part, and then I'd do it, and then I'd be, you know, I'd just be water off my back, or something like that, but then it just seemed like I wasn't working hard. I don't know, for some reason, then my teammate thought I wasn't working hard, and then she would, when things would go wrong, she started taking things out on me. This isn't my professor, but then she'd say things, and then people would all of a sudden I was incompetent or something. And it was, I thought about it. There were times where I was really hurt by this, and I thought about it, and I was I'm just not assertive. I'm not saying the work is still hard. I just do it, and then it's done. I don't say anything about it, and I'm just okay, what's next? But it's hard for me to be that assertive. I kind of wish that I had an advisor that asked more about how I was doing, instead of just being business, because his other students are more expressive about their feelings. So then he gets it, you know. That's one. There's a lot of stuff.
That could be a gender thing too, because a lot of guys myself, we don't really hear until someone steps on our toes and says, "Look, I'm hurting. You got to deal with my concerns." I think Jane might have something to say about that too, because in the corporate world,
it's funny. In the corporate world, we have some of the things that we see when we work with Asians, and we work with Asians, and we also work with management, right, to help them understand what the dynamics are and all that. One of the things that when you work in a company, one of the things you want to do when you're successful is to get promotions, right, or to move up in some way, or to get a different opportunity so that you can move up at some other point. And the way you do that, especially in a large company, is you kind of have to not just work hard and put your head down and plow your way through, which kind of many of us were taught to do that, right? The way you succeed in school is you take your work and you go to your room and no extracurricular activities, you just work hard at it. And I think sometimes some of that applies to the workplace too. And they might be great at what they do, and the performance evaluations are really good. But the way you kind of move up to the next level is you kind of have to build relationships, right? It's not just you and your boss that needs to know about how well you're doing. You have to actually have advocates in five different departments and say, have you thought about this person for this opportunity? Because she's actually really good.
Yeah.
You may not know about her, but I do know her, and I don't know her as well as intimately, but I've heard that she exists. Or I've had lunch with her, I've mentored her. So there's that need to kind of have there too. So I do see that there's a lack of understanding on both Asians and also people who work with them. So of course, you know, the perceptions that people make are based on what people see. And so both sides, there's gaps, right? So it's like Asians, they're just doing their thing. It's like, well, I'm really working hard. I'm working till midnight. Why am I not getting this promotion, right? I'm told that if I do this, X plus Y equals promotion, right? So they're not getting that. On the other hand, the people who are looking at them, the management or, you know, the people who are evaluating them are thinking, you know, they're just not, you know, selling themselves. So they're not promoting themselves. Nobody knows who they are.
Yeah.
So how are you going to get the thought about for other opportunities when no one knows them, right? So you have an evaluation committee, and it's not done by one person. So your manager might be there, but there's eight other people who say, okay, let's think about who's going to be evaluated for promotion to VP. And your name comes up. Your manager says she's excellent. She's rated at 5 the last 3 years. Her clients love her. Her performance evaluations are like this. But, you know, and so that's brought up. Does anybody else have anything to say? Or if somebody says something negative, you know, I don't know. I don't know if she's really been tested in this leadership capability. I don't know if she's able to do these kinds of things. So I'm not sure about her executive presence or whatever. But no one's there to defend that. No one knows who she is.
Exactly.
So that can really be a detriment in that way. So there's a lot of misunderstandings on both sides. And I think one of the things that I think I want to do more work with is getting the white male engagement or the senior executive engagement on working with more diverse teams. Because I think the diversity programs focus so much on the people who are impacted, like the women, African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, people with disabilities, people who are, you know, gay, lesbian, LGBT community. I mean, you name it, right? But we don't focus enough on how does from the top-down process, how can we change the organization to think about this problem in a sense that, you know, you actually help them to see how they lead and work with other people has to have a sense of cultural competency. So that is actually the more challenging thing, and actually takes a lot longer to accomplish that.
Yes.
But we're starting to see some glimmers of hope in a few organizations. But it's a challenge. And what you're facing right now is kind of a microcosm of what I see every day as we go into some of these organizations.
I think diversity is a huge issue. Because I feel like I only thrive when everyone's different enough to accept that we're all different, whereas we're forced into places where everyone's very similar.
That's great. I like to, you know, with our remaining time, do two things. One is to sort of share a large big picture concept that comes out of my field, so to speak. But the other one is then to get some of the nuts and bolts that Jane is starting to talk about how to get through this process. And you've already hinted at some of those major things that you must do, like networking and developing relationships. And as an aside, Isaac has a relationship with the Association for Theological Schools. That's the credentialing agency for all the seminaries in America. And we're helping them to do the very thing that you're talking about. How do we get the leadership of the schools to diversify, to learn how to competently work with diversity? And leadership, of course, is primarily white men. So I'd like to share notes with you on that. Let me share with you this last piece. And then you see that the table there on the back of your page? This serves more as a heuristic or just an explanatory way of a grid to look at what it is that where Asian Americans fit in the entire Western tradition of academics. Okay, it's big, broad based. Those of you who are familiar with the history of philosophy or history of Western civilization are aware that since the 18th century, in fact, Europeans and Americans, our educational system has moved into a very highly, I guess, intellectually rationalistic model.
I think we're missing page 2.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's all on page 1. I'm sorry. It's on page 1. That table right in the middle. No, I'm using the full notes, which I will share with you. My notes have more written stuff on it. I'm giving you the outline. You see that chart there. I'm sorry. And what I wanted to argue is that from a vantage point of a history of ideas, what we're seeing in Western culture, which explains how those of us who are Asian sort of get moved about, is that since the 18th and 19th century, Western society has moved into a dichotomous orientation, okay, between a public world and a private world. Okay, prior to the modern Enlightenment period, public and private were not recognized as two separate categories. Okay, it was, you know, if you would, for example, if you wanted to survive, you would garden, you know, and till your own farm and kill your own chickens, you know. But in the modern industrial age, the public sector and the private sector separated. And in the process, not only was this an economic and social reality, but we also see this affecting the intellect, the thinking process. So here are some categories. I'll just go through this quickly. So today, we're living in this type of, with this legacy in modern Western education, that there is a sense that the public is the society and the private is the individual. Okay, that's one category. So whatever you do individually is not part of the large society. Where did that concept come from? And there's also, you know, research done about how Asian communities are more communal. Well, in Western society, that's separated. Okay. Secondly, there's a privileging of science over religion. Okay. So every university system will always put a lot more attention to the hard sciences. And if you're studying religion, they don't know where that fits. And it becomes thrown into liberal arts, and maybe it's worthwhile, but it's not really valued. So you can't talk about religion very openly in a public school. Another one is the separation between institutional religion and personal religion, the private faith versus the church and congregations, secular, sacred, rational, and non-rational. Okay. Now, that, all of that sounds, I think, is fairly simple. It makes sense, right? When you think about life, this is how we live our lives. All right, there's two parts in the world, two worlds that we live in. Then you have male and female, the privileging of males over females, and the privileging of the West over the Orient, the privileging of white Anglo-Saxons over non-whites. All of these emerge at the same time. So what we're looking at here with the Enlightenment model is how Western colonialism has basically not only conquered economically but also intellectually, has imposed itself, these categories, upon wherever it has landed. And we happen to be caught right in the middle of that. So whatever field you're in, like for example, I'm in the area of religion and religious studies and history, I find sometimes I don't have a place in the university to speak about issues because my issues are not important to the university. The important issues for the university are international politics or business and science. So this is a one where I think if you see this framework, and we could spend a lot more time looking at this in depth, it helps explain why where we are as faith people of faith, as Asians, what happens to us when we get caught into this grid. Because even if people want to break this and try to recognize this as equal competent people, this is still the grid that our current academic system operates under. And it's changing, but it's still there. Let me just stop there and give you a chance to feedback a little bit about this overview. And it's not something that I'm making up. It's derived from this book. Richard King, Orientalism and Religion, Postcolonial Theory. And so is this something you're familiar with, this framework? You probably are. So those of you who are in the more hard sciences, this is probably a different kind of way of looking at your field. But if you know that's where you are, then I hope this will help you recognize that when you interact with faith issues, that's why faith is always so, you feel so schizophrenic, because when you're dealing with your academic work, it's almost as if there's no desire to connect with your faith at all. This framework, I think, is one, if I had more time, we would spend more time looking at your specific situation. But it also is the reason why our faith and our race becomes problematized, and gender too, those of you who are women. Okay. Now, given that framework, what's going on? The academic world is changing. The most cutting-edge scholars who are doing post-colonial research and post-modern research are beginning to question this. And I think that's a good thing. Those of us who are Christians who are also engaging in this are also questioning this, because Christians get marginalized too. It doesn't matter if you're a white Christian or Asian or non-white Christian. So consequently, we're trying to, the cutting edge scholarship is trying to find a new way of conceptualizing intellectual integrity. Okay. So how do you survive this while this educational system is changing? I'll throw out a few quick ideas, and then we'll try to end with some of your feedback. I wrote down in three final sections how to enter academia, how to finish the doctoral program, and how to sustain yourself. Well, we don't have time to cover all that. Which one do you want to go with? Just tell me. Okay, but let's start with the first one, because that's the simplest. For one, some practical ways of thinking about entering the doctoral program if you're not in it yet. And all of you, except for a couple of you, are not in it. But one is, this will be quick. Make sure you shape your undergrad or master's research for your doctoral studies. Plan your dissertation before you apply. Some of you have already in it, so no big deal. Secondly, even if you're in an undergrad program or a master's program and you're not in a doctoral program, participate in your particular society's conferences, your scholarly society's conferences and activities, and then follow Jane's advice. When you're there, network like crazy. Mm. Okay, you got to know who the leaders are in your field, and you cannot be shy about trying to talk to them. Even though they might look at you as this peon Asian guy or Asian woman, you still have to get there and somehow get a handshake in there and talk to them. And this applies across the board, every field. Okay, I just don't see, and this is the thing that I had to learn, because I'm really an introvert. I don't like doing that kind of stuff. But I had to learn to do this when I started to go to academic societies. Network, network, network. And then as you're applying for doctoral programs, study the program carefully and focus on finding a good mentor rather than the reputation of the school. A mentor will carry, and this is true for me because I had a wonderful mentor, my mentor who passed away when he was really very young. He was a man of faith. He knew how difficult it was for a person with my background as an evangelical Asian American to go to a liberal school to deal with that, and he helped mentor me through it. So find a good mentor in a doctoral program. And this is where, this is the first step. Now, how do you finish a doctoral program? I'll race through these pieces quickly as well, and stop me if you want me to stop. I don't mind doing that. Select seminars and courses around your topic. You know, this is practical advice. So don't go all over the map. Stay focused. Recruit and cultivate a positive relationship with your dissertation committee, if you have one. And this, again, is Jane's advice. Find the people you like to work with you, who will advocate for you, and keep them loyal to you. How do you keep them loyal to you? Make them your Facebook friend, I don't know. Poke them a lot, you know, send them gifts. Whatever you need to do just to make sure that you are aware that you care about them, and you hope that they will reciprocate. Okay. Make sure that they become your friends. Do your best to make as many friends as you can. I didn't do that too well, honestly. When I was going through my doctoral program, I was a pastor at the same time. So I didn't really network with my professor friends or my colleagues. So one of the biggest hurdles I've had to deal with afterwards was trying to land in an educational setting where I'm happier, because no one in the field really knows me, and none of my colleagues would vouch for me because I didn't do a good job doing that. Consequently, I've done better, but when I was in doctoral program, I didn't. I know it's hard. You're busy, you're focusing on your work, but you got to take time out to do this socializing, to networking, parties. Okay, maybe not parties, but dinners, go to coffees, go to social activities, go to lectureships. Find a place where you can meet somebody, make your presence felt, and gradually develop a good core of friends who will support you. Okay. Maintain communication with your advisor and dissertation committee. That's a third suggestion. Make sure that you're always in conversation. There are times when I felt very ashamed because I didn't make much progress with my dissertation. So I spent 3 months without talking to my advisor, and he forgot about me. You know, things like that happen. But I would say, even if you don't make progress with your dissertation, try to make a discipline and a habit to talk to your advisor. Because even if you have to confess that you haven't made much progress, at least let that person know that you're still alive. It's very, very important. In your dissertation, do not write a magnus opus. This is going to be your first and crappiest work ever. Just get that over with. Seriously, your intellectual development begins after you finish the dissertation. There are only a very, very, very few people who are so idiot savants who can make their dissertation the Nobel Prize winning essay. you and I, most of us, are not going to do that. So just get it over with and hurry through. don't linger. Just get the blank out of there. And in the process, take time out to research as many job openings and postdoctoral fellowships as possible. Mm. Do not be selective. Because you never know. You know, I mean, I had a hard time getting my first job. Again, it was for me, God's grace, because I just didn't know what I was doing. But basically, look at every single angle, every possibility, and when you start to narrow your focus, you really, really research that institution well. Find out who are the professors there, who's on a search committee, who are the key players, try to get to know them. Do not be apologetic, even if they tell you no phone calls, no phone queries. Just be aggressive and try your best to ask as many questions as you can. Meet people officially or unofficially. Do not ever worry about protocol. Or I shouldn't say that, but without looking really, really like you're stepping over the boundaries, be aggressive.
Just add something to that too. I think it's probably also important if you're looking for your first thing out of your PhD program is to actually find a better support system versus the most prestigious program.
Yeah.
I think if you can get really good experience with a really great advisor, I don't know what the head of the department is, whatever, who cares about you and can invest in your development, that's more valuable, especially because you can always move in the future. I believe you can. Mm-hmm. And if you're talented, you've got some value to add. There'll be organizations that will want to. So I think it's good to get a good start and do some significant things at even a smaller place or a place that will support you and will be interested in your development versus a huge, the most prestigious organization out there that doesn't really care, right? And then you kind of have to figure out how to navigate that.
Right.
So I see the same thing for corporate folks too. It's like if you can get, maybe first job out of school is a large company to get training, but if you can get your next set of experiences at a medium size or even a small company where they let you do everything or let you do a lot of things and kind of spread your wings, try some things out here and there, that's a better experience. Mm-hmm. And you can take that anywhere.
Yep.
And you can make a name for yourself, you know, for God's kingdom, or in any way, in that way. And I think that you'll probably come out feeling like you've accomplished something versus just a name attached to you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you're not exactly sure how you got there.
So. Absolutely. As a person of faith, our priorities are not just our careers. So your health, your ability to be able to be a strong Christian witness requires a good support system. In my experience, when I went to Denver Seminary, I went there primarily because that was my only job option. I didn't really want to go there. I had bad feelings about that particular community. But I went there, suffered for a couple of years, had to deal with the different cultures there and had to address that. But then my second job was one where the people really cared about me in Rochester. Even though I didn't really like living in Rochester that much, I still, as you said, it was people who were loving, caring. My peers were my peers. My colleagues had children the same age as my kids. That was my best experience ever in academia. When I came out to California, I took a chance because the school I went to had some problems. So in retrospect, I think you're right. It's good to find a place where you know who will support you, more so than who will give you the most prestige.
We have 10 minutes.
Okay, we're done. Don't worry, we'll be done. I hope I didn't bore you, but third part, sustaining yourself. This is for some of you who are, probably this is more pertinent to you. If you're a grad student or a new faculty, one of the toughest things for those of us who are in academia is to learn to be humble, because we're considered top-notch scholars. What I learned through my experience is that we might think we're good, but it doesn't mean anyone else does. Because the academic community, in the end, is still a very small market in the wider world. And that was, I came to that rude awakening when I left my teaching position 2 years ago to start Isaac. It was very different because the people I talked to no longer treated me with the kind of deference I used to have. Oh, Professor so-and-so. It was like, okay, what are you all about now? And I had to find a different source of emotional support for my ego. So, that's the first big trap for anyone who's made it, who's got the PhD, who's now teaching. Do not approach things with a sense of superiority. It's hard, because sometimes students make you feel like, you know, Because some students are like that, right? but I would say that the best advice is to continue to retain a sense of humility and friendliness as much as you can. Do not try your best to get along. And this is true for older faculty, too. I think the faculty who survive are the ones who don't begin to promote themselves too much, at least emotionally. And I think that was probably one of the things I probably made a mistake in, because I thought I was hot stuff coming to the school I came to in Berkeley. And I didn't realize that the power dynamics there didn't matter. How good I was in the academic field, it wouldn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's the relationships in the school that matter more than anything else. So if you want to get tenured, remember, you got to get that relationship back there, keep the relationships going. It doesn't matter how good you are and how well-recognized you are outside your school. It's the people in your school who tenure you are the ones you have to be accountable to. Okay? Care about your institution and respect its administrators. Okay? Don't abuse your secretary, make her or him write your next book. That happens, you know.
Oh, man.
Find ways to be an advocate, to mentor younger scholars. And this is another one which took me a while to figure out. When I was in my 30s, I was busy building my career. But later on, I started to realize that there are some younger scholars who are like myself, who have gone through the same struggles. It's my calling to help them. So maybe it's too early for you, but keep that in mind. Someday you will be a mentor. Continue to participate in scholarly conferences and activities. My scholarly society is the American Academy of Religion. I hate that society.
Of what?
The American Academy of Religion.
Oh.
Yes. 18,000 people gather together in big cities talking about who knows what. Because if you are in religious studies, there is no such thing as a discipline called religious studies. Religious studies is basically everything thrown together. So I go to these meetings. These sessions are boring. They really are. And there's just nothing there that I like, because it's such a broad, diverse group. But I go anyway. And I have to go and maintain networks and friendships. Okay, and then as you get older in your research, do the research and teaching that matter to you. In the beginning, you're doing it to get into the system. But once you found yourself a nice place, figure out what it is that you're called to research. And I think this is a faith question. It's not just what's interesting or where you can get the best research grant, although that's important. But what is it, where is the passion that you have, and how that affects your sense of who you are? And finally, cultivate a vibrant spiritual life. It is so tempting to just sit back and do nothing. Because the academic pace of life is different, it's slower. So I would encourage those of you who are not in the theology and religious studies to spend some time reading outside your discipline. And those of us who are, and I'm learning how to read more in the organizational management and some business as well. By virtue of the role I'm playing now. But it's good to use that time to go get broader and as a way to refurbish and strengthen your spiritual life. So with that, I'm going to stop here and give you time to just give me some more feedback. And in the meantime, I'm going to hand out this a review of Jane's book. Yeah, I'm sorry. This didn't go as planned. But what I wanted to do was just give you a chance to see that So any thoughts or any feedback before we go? Maybe we can continue this conversation online or whatever.
Well, I have a comment. Thank you so much for being pretty candid, I think. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I do go to professors, they give me the answers they wouldn't tell their own children. They give me the generic answer, and yeah, it doesn't help me at all. And your language and your own humor, et cetera, definitely made it a lot more accessible and personable, so I thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. This is what I want to do. I like doing this. This is fun. I see myself sort of as a coach. Having gone through that, yeah. Any other, not necessarily feedback, but other reflections? I hope it was helpful. Yeah, I really do.
I just thought of it right now. I really appreciated the sharing in regards to the idea of promotion and self-promotion. I know there are probably a lot of reasons and sources for that, but I was just thinking about why that idea seems foreign to me, because I know I have problems with that too. And I think part of it is because when I think about God, our Father, I don't feel like I need to self-promote myself.
Yeah.
And trying to reconcile that idea of someone who knows me intimately well mm-hmm. with the idea that, well, but I live in a broken world where that's not true.
Yeah, I think it's good to be honest that, number one, our egos do need feeding, and we're in a system where we are rewarded for our work. So there's a need to at least recognize that. But on the other hand, I also think it's a question of positioning. If you are able to position yourself in your field well, you will be, it's a stewardship question, you'll be much more effective at advancing God's kingdom. So there is a need to take care of and to cultivate that, and don't just simply play the game of humble all the time and not promoting oneself. I think
you take ownership of what you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to add to this one also, is, as you think about talking about your work, and I think it might be helpful to think about the underlying value you work provides. Mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. that helps. We actually did an exercise in Business Track yesterday to help the participants understand what are the skills that you're using and what is the underlying value of what you're doing versus just a job title.
Right.
Instead of saying, I'm an accountant that does this, mm-hmm. what are you doing?
Right.
Are you exploring the way? Are you managing relationships? Are you doing things that actually have an underlying value underneath that? So that's helpful. And also, when you're promoting and talking about yourself to the people that need to consider you for tenure track or whatever, to kind of think about, even though you're not used to doing it, to kind of think about doing it in your own style. Because mm-hmm. I think, people can kind of sniff out when it's kind of like, oh, he's just doing it because he has to do it.
Right.
Kind of thing. So it's easy to figure out a way to be genuine. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I'm rooming with somebody who's heading up the healthcare track. She's actually head of anesthesiology at the University of Washington. Mm. She said there was this one Asian guy who came up to her after something that she did recently and started selling himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like he got some training on how to be assertive and how to promote yourself in this way. And she was like, well, easy, take it easy. Out of all the stuff you just told me, what are you the most passionate about? And he didn't know what to say about that. And I don't know. I just do this. I want to get into a good fellowship program. This is what I want to do. It's like he couldn't articulate why he was selling himself in a deep way. And she wanted to know that, right? Because she's a believer and all that. Now, of course, if you've got a believer on the other end of this self-promotion thing that you're doing, that's good. And hopefully they'll see the value of what you're trying to do. But as you're thinking about what to say and how to communicate what you want to do, it's really think about what exactly do you like doing in your research? And what value does that provide to the organization, to the school, and also what do you value in that process? So really think about that. And don't just think about selling it. Know what you want to sell and actually talk about it. Really think deeply about it. You don't have to be kind of, what do you call it, setting up a business card. It's not that kind of networking.
Right, exactly. Right?
True networking is really about
there's some honesty there, right, that you have to be. My son is going through his college applications and he's writing his essays. Same concept. He can't just sell himself like that. He has to be honest and true to himself as he's writing his essays. So, absolutely. Thank you.
3-minute answer.
I really appreciate Jane coming because she's already written a book about this in the corporate world, and I'm just sharing whatever I comes out of my experience. But I do hope that we can continue the conversation because it goes deeper, and I really am praying and hoping that your faith will. And your sense of racial identity will, even though it sometimes is difficult, you can find ways to fight through it and overcome. So,
everyone, let's thank Tim.
Shall we close the prayer? I'll be happy to share a quick prayer. Dear gracious God, thank you for just gathering us here for this intimate time of sharing and unloading sometimes, and also opening our eyes, because in the end, the academic world is really just a different form of the marketplace. And to be in ministry in the marketplace in the academics world requires sets of skills and awareness and understanding that's very similar to anything we do in our lives. So I just pray to you that this time of sharing would be at least the tip of the iceberg of the continuing quest for wisdom to live our faith the way you've called us to live, to be your disciples, to be your witnesses, so that the world may know that in Jesus Christ there's hope. In Jesus' name I pray.
Amen. And I continue to invite you, ask this man to dinner. He's an amazing mentor. Unless you are involved in this focus group, please have dinner. He will be here till tomorrow?
I leave really early tomorrow morning.
Okay.
So,
So have an opportunity to grab this.
Thank you, Jane. This is a real treat to have you here.
It's nice to, yeah, it's good to